Today's program is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit rt11.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 147 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
On today's show, Katrina Birchmeyer, General Manager of Williamsburg Wine Bar, The Four Horsemen. Welcome to The Morning After, Katrina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sari.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay.
How's your week been?
Really?
Well, Sari invented a cocktail last night.
I did.
And she's still feeling it this morning. I'm sorry, this afternoon.
Well, no, I invented it a long time ago. I named it last night.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was the naming ceremony.
Yes. Yes.
So what was it?
Well, it's a dirty martini with Clamato in it. And I've been drinking it for a long time. I don't know if this is the first time I've said that out loud. so I decided to name it the Dirty Clam.
And I think that's an amazing name for a cocktail. I would totally order
that. It's a bit of an homage.
An homage to clams.
No, to you.
Oh, merci buckets. Merci buckets. What's in Clamato?
Clam juice.
Tomato.
Tomatoes. Or tomatoes.
So clams and tomatoes. That's why it's Clamato.
Clams and tomatoes. And then like some chemicals, like maybe citric acid and some other things.
Well, that's when the alcohol probably kills any of that stuff that's bad for you, right?
Yes. I prefer it with blue cheese olives, if possible. Highly recommended.
You're so classy.
I know, right?
I love you.
I drink Clamato out of a can, but my olives have blue cheese.
Classy as shit. All right. Well, do you have some weird food news for us today?
Oh, yeah. That's actually a great point. I do.
And Katrina, please weigh in if anything is worthy of your opinion.
Can't wait to hear what's happening. What's
happening in the food world since you're stuck in a restaurant not knowing what's going on.
Speaking of dirty clams, have you guys heard about rainbow Doritos?
Oh, no.
Doritos have gone gay.
Doritos are out?
Doritos are out, yeah. Doritos have joined forces with an LGBT organization. Which is called itgetsbetter.org, which is a wonderful organization, and we here support it. But if you donate to this organization, at least $10 or more, Doritos will send you a bag of gay Doritos, which are rainbow-colored.
That cost you $10.
That cost you $10. So for $10, you get additional colored Doritos in purple and green and yellow, and you can eat them and feel like, you know, You're gay. And you love
it. I was thinking you eat them and you think it gets better, but like when anybody's at the bottom of a bag of Doritos, do you feel like anything's ever going to get better?
Well, maybe like it gets better because your Doritos are in better colors.
You know, I always was under the stupid assumption that, you know, the corn chip is white and the nacho cheese is orange. So what do you think's in like a green? Is green in the gay flag?
Oh yeah,
is there, it's a rainbow.
It's leprechaun. And what's purple? Grape.
Stop it. It's not flavored.
I haven't had them. I have to donate $10.
And then they omit the Cool Ranch Dorito from
oh,
the
no,
rainbow.
No. I just remember they're all Cool Ranch flavored.
Really?
Oh. Yes, really, they're all Cool Ranch. They just are different colors.
So I wonder,
which I think like, it's kind of a ripoff. Like if you're gonna get different colors, you should get different flavors.
I don't know if that works.
I think the gays need to get together and protest.
Well, I was just thinking, like, is the Cool Ranch for the lesbians and the nacho cheese for the gay men? I don't know. I prefer some Cool Ranch.
That's... I don't know. They're they're all taco flavor.
Anyway, I think we should all go get a bag.
Yeah, you got to go online. You have to do online. Yeah, and then they'll mail them to you. Mm. You can't just purchase
them. So they'll
them.
Be completely smashed.
It's going to be
gay rainbow confetti.
Rainbow smash. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think some people are annoyed that, you know, they think Doritos are like capitalizing off of gay rights, but either way, itgetsbetter.org. Okay. Well, some good news. Olive Garden's unlimited pasta passes. That was hard to say. Are back. Great. And yet they sold out in under 1 second this year. Yeah. Yeah. We all remember last year we had actually a guest on the show who possessed one of these Olive Garden Never Ending pasta passes.
And then like wrote a diary about it.
Wrote
every
like,
day.
Yeah, some.
Oh,
yeah.
You can go every day for free.
You can. Last year, I believe it took 2 minutes for them to sell out, but this year under a second. So that's pretty impressive. This time there was about 2,000 of them up for grabs. I think you can go as much as you want for 7 weeks, but this year they have a new caveat. You can only use them for takeout 2 meals a day. Because I think some people were benefiting. They were getting meals, taking them out, and then giving them to homeless people. And this year Olive Garden was like, no more of that. We will not be giving our free pasta to homeless people. You have to sit in this restaurant and eat the pasta or we can see you. So,
Katrina, you're from Australia. Have you ever been, and you've only been in New York, for not even,
not
has
a year.
It been a year? Not even a year yet. No. Have you been to the Olive Garden?
I have not.
What?
I know. Well, if I had one of those passes, well, maybe, I guess I would. But
yeah, you could be friends with someone who has a pass and then maybe they will take
you. Sounds like a rare commodity.
It is. There's only 2,000 of them.
Do you have anything like Olive Garden in Australia?
Outback Steakhouse.
Yeah, I mean, there's some bad things.
Well, yes.
No, we don't really. So it's just like a pasta chain restaurant.
Yeah.
Mm,
but it's known because you get unlimited breadsticks and salad.
And soup.
And soup.
At lunch.
Yeah.
Oh. No.
Yeah, and there's some great, you can like kind of design your own combinations, I think, which is what
sounds
we learned.
Sounds amazing.
It does sound amazing.
I mean, when you're like 10 years old and you want to have your birthday party, you want to go eat at the Olive Garden.
That's,
I mean, that was what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Or when you live in Cleveland, Ohio.
Or when
you want to go out for a fancy meal.
Yeah, or when you're in college and you get stoned and you want to have an unlimited
a lot of food.
Basket of breadsticks.
My God, yes.
Totally. All right, what's next?
Yeah. Oh. I don't know.
I mean, you did say it was a pretty dim food news week.
I had something else.
Well, I mean,
oh, I know. Oh, there's a new gin, and it's called Unicorn Tears. Yeah,
oh.
Jesse's got a look that doesn't translate.
Actually,
on
have
camera.
Unicorn tear.
She just. Yeah, no, it's a new gin, and it costs. Here it is. It costs $62 a bottle. That's a lot, right, for a bottle of gin?
I don't think so.
Oh,
it's kind of normal, maybe.
I think gin,
kind of normal,
like small batch gin, probably.
Well, it's called Unicorn Tears Gin.
A lot,
and apparently it's a magical booze.
Okay.
No word though on whether real unicorns were harmed in the making of this gin, and whether they're happy tears or sad tears.
Just in: unicorns don't exist.
What?
Oh, what?
Then why does it cost $62 a bottle? But if they had tears, would they be gin flavored?
Probably not. I would think they'd be something like sweet or like Fountain of Youth water. Maybe something healthy.
Maybe not juniper tears.
Well, maybe the gin. Maybe this gin, you don't get hangovers. Put it in the dirty clam.
No, that would ruin it.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all I got.
Well, great. I mean, I can't wait to donate and get some
smashed rainbow Doritos.
Absolutely.
Wash them down with unicorn tears gin.
Perfect. We'll be back here on the morning after with Katrina Birchmeyer, the Four Horsemen. Don't hate it. Don't make some noise.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 potato chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
And we're back here on The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
All the way from Australia, front woman of the biggest wine bar opening in New York City this year, Katrina Birchmeyer of the Four Horsemen.
Hi.
Welcome to The Morning After.
Thank you.
So before you came to the Four Horsemen, you were co-owner of Garagiste in Tasmania?
That is correct.
Which is a part of Australia.
It is.
Even though it's an island.
It's a neglected part of Australia.
It's where devils come from.
It's an isolated part. That is true. Yeah, it's like off the bottom of the mainland, and it's quite isolated. But yeah, I had Garagiste for 5 years. And we also had a little bar called Sidecar, which we open up around the corner. And yeah, we basically were kind of pushing boundaries down there with natural wines and very unique food. Yeah, it was heaps of fun, very challenging. And I guess that's how they found me, to bring me here.
Yeah, so what was the wine scene like in Tasmania before you opened this restaurant?
Yeah, it was basically Tasmanian wine. So there's a like small growing wine industry, I guess, in Tasmania, and that would say was predominantly what you'd be seeing in restaurants around there, and also other Australian wines, but definitely nothing like what we were doing. It was quite interesting, the kind of people that came through early on and trying to open their minds to different things, and yeah.
I feel like before you, there was like 15 different kinds of Shiraz and nothing else.
Yeah, Pinot Noir. Lots of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and yeah, pretty much made by, I think like 80% of the wine in Tasmania is made by the same person.
Oh,
but
wow.
They just...
A yeah. Koala.
No, a Tasmanian devil, right. Actually.
So they like literally went to the... other end of the earth
to find you.
They're like, who is the most obscure, farthest person we can bring in?
They did. Yeah, I mean...
That's flattering.
Yeah, so it was kind of lucky. I mean, so one of the owners, Randy Moon, we've got a mutual friend in Sydney who's in the wine writing industry, and he connected us, and then I met everyone, and we all hit it off, and that was the beginning of it all.
And so why were they looking, I mean, were they necessarily looking for somebody outside of the New York scene?
They were. I mean, they did say that they were looking for someone with a different perspective and from, well, you know, a different, I mean, I don't know whether they were necessarily looking for someone from a different country, but they were definitely looking outside the New York industry. So they looked very far.
Well, it makes sense to me why they brought you. But my bigger question is, like, why did you leave? Because it sounds like, you know, you had a really nice thing going there.
Yeah, I mean, it was. We were also kind of coming towards the end of, like, our business. We had decided we were going to sell, and it was just ended up being the right timing for me to move on to a new project. So I moved here in November, and it was good, I was able to spend a lot of time helping with the setup, and we all got a lot of time together to know each other and like really nut out the concept and just like we just understand each other. So it was great in that sense. But yeah, it was definitely a big move. But I mean, you get offered a job in New York. I mean, who's not going to say yes?
Yeah. I mean, I guess you're landing in November,
yeah.
And then you spend your first New York winter. What was that like?
Awful. I mean, I don't even want to think about it. It was terrible. And everyone said it's the worst winter ever.
They say that every year.
Yeah, I figure that happens. But, you know, the Hudson froze. I was like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, you love summer. No.
No,
it's too
hot.
What is going on? But, yeah, winter was brutal. But, you know, really test your survival skills. But it was good. It was good. I bought lots of winter clothes that I'd never worn anything like it before. But yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I loved the snow for the first day, and then it got all brown, and I'm like, that's gross.
Yeah.
But
for the first day.
So not only are you coming to a different country, the biggest city in, yeah, you know, in the United States, you're also kind of coming on board with a very high profile opening.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you guys were in the New Yorker, you were in the Times,
yeah,
you were in everything before you even opened.
Yeah.
What was that pressure like?
Well, it was, I mean, interestingly, like early on when we were all discussing how, I mean, they wanted it to be more low key, but that, I mean, that was never going to happen. So early on, I'm like, oh, that's cool. Give us some time to kind of find our feet. No. You're in the New York Times and you haven't opened yet. I'm like, so, you know, there was a bit of pressure, but it's also, you just kind of go with it. And I remember, like talking with everyone early on, and James is very, he's great. He's very process. He likes to know how things.
Do you mind just kind of explaining, like, for the listeners?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Who's,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So James Murphy from LCD and Sound System and his wife, Christina, and then Randy Moon, and Justin Cherno as well. So he's kind of the, yeah, and Justin's our wine advisor, and they all, I mean, Justin and James are good long-term friends, and I don't know how Randy came into the fold, but he came into the fold. Yeah, so I remember, like, James is like, well, how do we know this, and how do you calculate that? And I'm like, you just wing it. And I think he kind of looked at me like, who did we just employ? Someone who's just going to wing it. And I'm like,
yeah,
anyway.
It's a very un-New York-y attitude to kind of just be like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, you just kind of have to go with it.
That's probably
why
they wanted
it. You know, there was pressure with the opening, and obviously, like, I with any restaurant opening, things take longer than expected. And so, but, you know, I felt ready. I felt like we'd had enough time to kind of get ourselves ready for it and, you know, recruit a good team. And so when we started, it was like, it just kind of flowed, and it's been flowing ever since. So, you know, I feel really fortunate for such a good opening, and having that publicity, I think, has been really good as well, because it meant we were busy from the get-go. It means your staff are enthusiastic and inspired because there's lots of people coming through the door. So it's been really good. But yeah, there was definitely some pressure, but... Yeah.
Besides the winter, though, was there any other sort of, like, culture shock that you experienced? I mean, either personally or because, like, this is your first time doing an opening in New York and such a and it being such a high-profile place.
Yeah, winter, that was a thing. I mean, not anything really that felt really hard or scary. I mean, I guess actually probably more, like, leading up to arriving here, I was like, how the hell am I going to open a restaurant in New York City? I mean, I came from a small city in Australia, in an island off Australia. I'm like, how am I going to do this? So that was kind of scary. But I mean, no, I don't think I've really had too much culture shock. I mean, the restaurant industry is different in the way it operates. So I'm not going to go into, you know, the ins and outs of that. But it's definitely been a steep learning curve and a really good one. But no, I can't think of anything that's really kind of shocked me as much as winter did.
With someone like James Murphy from LCD Sound System opening a restaurant or opening a wine bar, did you feel like there was any criticism from the wine community or any judgment? Because he was obviously the front person of the entire opening, even though there's three other owners.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't experience any. I think that there was concern that the place would just always be James Murphy's wine bar. But I think, and, you know, the articles before we opened were kind of more skewed towards him. And I think since that, the media has picked up on this being an interesting place and something that is a little bit different, I realize, in the city. I mean, I didn't experience any backlash or any kind of weird feelings, and maybe I was protected from that in some way, but I didn't find any weird things going on. But I think, I definitely know that James was concerned that it was going to be just about, you know, him as a front man. And I think he's very, very happy that it's not ended up like that. Like, it's just taken its own momentum and it's grown.
I mean, I think the fact that he surrounded himself by, like, really professional people who are authorities on those subjects was a good move.
Well, it proves he knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Or at least brought in people who did.
Exactly.
So one aspect of James, though, what he really knows is sound, is music. What are the specificities of noise and your soundtrack at Four Horsemen?
Well, there was definitely a lot of research that went into I've just lost my train of thought. Like the acoustics, acoustics in the venue. So there's like, you know, pretty much everything is hard surfaces, but he used materials like cedar wood which absorbs sound, and burlap coating on the walls. And there's also like other soundproofing stuff there. He did all his shopping on eBay for, you know, amps and speakers and all this kind of stuff. He knows all the tricks of like finding the good stuff cheap, like things that are spelt incorrectly on eBay but is the real deal and stuff like that. And then the music itself was all about just playing albums and like a whole range of music.
Yeah, I read there's no Spotify allowed.
There's no Spotify, and I must say, I don't know shit about music, so I can't comment too much. I just know we hit a button and music plays all night.
And that's good.
So that's good for me.
Does anyone ever come in and like expect to hear LCD sound system all night?
I mean, people kind of have little jokes. Oh, I'm surprised I'm not hearing LCD sound system. But that actually is a specification. No LCD sound system.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figured it would be that way.
Yeah.
I feel like every restaurant has that one thing that guests always talk about.
Yeah.
And of course they're talking about that.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you work on the wine list, or were you a bit removed from that?
No, I was involved in that from the beginning. So Justin and I did a lot of work on that together. Like even back before I'd even moved here, we were having conversations about wine, and we still work very closely together on pulling the wine list together, and which is a lot of fun. There's some new things here that I'd never tasted before, so it's exciting.
Yeah, I read that there's definitely an emphasis on natural wine.
Yeah, there is. So I mean, I know that term, and I know particularly in Australia, I don't know how it is here, but there's always a bit of contention and funny thoughts about what natural wine is. But I really like that term, and I think it describes what we're serving. And, that is our focus. So we've got, you know, predominantly wines from France and Italy. There's a little bit of domestic stuff, and we're pulling in some interesting orange wines from like Republic of Georgia and Slovenia, and that's a lot of fun to be able to do that.
So I feel like wine bar can be a loaded term,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if it was like that in Tasmania or in Australia, but in New York I feel like people think wine bar and they think that's not dinner.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that we talked about a lot before opening. The image or whatever of a wine bar here is very different to, say, Europe or like Japan or even Australia. And we basically have set the restaurant up. So there is like the wine, the bar bit at the front, and there's also table seating down the back, and the menu is the same throughout the whole venue. And, you know, we have restaurant quality food in a small space, and you can have that at the bar, you can have a like interesting snack, or you can make a big meal out of it. So that was definitely something that was on our mind from the beginning, trying to create that sort of atmosphere and build that kind of new image of what a wine bar can be. So it can be good beverages with interesting food. It doesn't have to be.
Is that what you mean when you said that it's the term is different in America than it is in other countries?
Yeah.
Like the food takes more of a backseat in other places.
I would say the food takes a backseat in the US.
In the States. Oh, I see. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right? Like people in Europe, you drink wine with food. That is what wine is on the table with dinner. That's when you drink wine.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the whole idea behind the Four Horsemen was to kind of recreate a European style venue. In a way. Yeah.
I mean, coming from working in a wine bar that is actually not done well at the end, like it mm-hmm. started, it opened well and mm-hmm. it kind of petered off. I think that was, you know, a problem of ours. And
yeah. I think, you know, we are still in the initial stages, but in the very early days, people would definitely come in to try and work out what we were. And people are like, so are you a wine bar or a restaurant? I'm like, no, we're a place where you can eat and drink. Like, you don't have to define it.
Yeah, people here really like to categorize.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and then people come and experience it. It's always a good vibe and the food's always really tasty. You can get some interesting wine. And I think that in the end, that overrides trying to categorize it as anything.
Yeah. Is there a specific philosophy behind the food? And if so, like, how does that work or not in conjunction with the wine philosophies?
So the food is very much based around the seasons, and it's, you know, so the menu will change regularly. The food that we serve is towards the lighter, kind of fresher, brighter flavors, some more kind of subtle flavors, and that ties in well with the wine that, you know, we don't have. I mean, yes, there's definitely some intense flavors in some of the wines, but, you know, in general, there's like a lot of subtleties, and the wines go very well with sort of like fresher style food. And yeah, it's all kind of a bringing naturalness back to what we're eating and drinking, I guess.
The name has, you know, it's kind of a bold name. I mean, people associate it with the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
What, I mean, I know there are four owners. Mm-hmm. What, I mean, what brought them to using that?
You know what? I don't know the whole story. I think, you know, part of it was, I think there's like some Metallica song or something. Again, I don't know music.
Very likely.
Something along that those lines. And then, yeah, the four owners. And I think like early on when they kind of grouped together, they did this event in, I think maybe it was in Toronto, I can't remember, wherever it was, but their name on the poster for this like food, wine, music event was the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. So, you know.
Eno, yeah. As in wine.
Yeah, exactly,
in
yeah, yeah.
Oh, so, it's too bad they dropped that.
Yeah, it's a bit long.
It is a bit long, especially for Williamsburg.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Williamsburg, it's on 295 Grand Street.
Yep.
The J gets you there, the L gets you there.
Yep.
And Instagram Uber. And Uber for sure.
And Uber.
And the taxi. They
not
go,
our
they,
sponsor.
They go to Brooklyn now.
No, the taxis, no. Just no. Take an Uber.
Just take an Uber. Perfect. And the Instagram is FourHorsemanBK. That's four spelled out. Katrina Birchmeyer, thank you so much for being on The Morning After.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back with The Morning After quiz. We'll see how Katrina does.
Down to earth, Gucci around the purse, bougie never. Shoes be matching with a poofy leather. Down to earth, Gucci around the purse, bougie never. Shoes be matching with a poofy leather.
You still paying attention? Are you there? Hello, 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 hello. I'm talking to you. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
And we're back here on The Morning After. Katrina, it's time for The Morning After quiz. Three questions, all multiple choice.
I'm terrible at multiple choice.
All right. Well, good. That's good for me and my quiz writing. All right. So, Katrina, you know all about your wine bar, The Four Horsemen, but what do you know about the 1962 film, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse? You've seen it, right?
No.
No?
I haven't even seen new releases, so I haven't seen old films.
There's no movies in Tasmania.
Yeah, right?
They just drink wine and, like, cut fields. I don't know. Is there an outback in Tasmania?
There's outback. Australia is just outback.
Okay. All right. Good. I mean, I've never been. I know that the toilet water goes the wrong way.
I don't know. I've never actually taken much notice, but I've heard that.
Exactly. Exactly. Well,
that's not true.
Here we go. The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, 1962 film. Question one. Symbolizing conquest, war, famine, and death, What major historical event do the Four Horsemen represent in the film? Is it A, World War II? Is it... Tasmania was in that, right?
Tasmania didn't exist then. No, just kidding.
B, Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire? Or C, the French Revolution? So it's like, what historical event do these does the Four Horsemen represent in this film?
B.
You say B, the rise and fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
It's actually A, World War II, but you know what? I'm going to give you a little bit of credit because the many people have like analyzed the Book of Revelations.
Yeah, and, I mean, I also had, so that's why I said B.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Right before you came here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so like they think, you know, biblical, the people who wrote the Bible, you know, God.
Or the people.
The people. The people who wrote the Bible. it was during the time of the Roman Empire, and so that was kind of predicting the rise and fall of the Roman Empire.
So
anyway,
half point.
I'm gonna get out. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how you do. Gosh. Respect. so the film is the story of a large Argentine family who have one family member in the French Resistance and one family member who becomes a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's a lot of stuff going on there. So before the start of World War II, Madariaga, who is the head of a large Argentine cattle ranching family, obviously the main character in the show, learns that his grandson has become a Nazi. What is his reaction? Is it A, he hails Hitler to the surprise of his family? Is it B, he challenges him to a cattle roping contest because they own a cattle ranch? Or is it C, he slaps him and then drops dead?
Oh. Oh, shit.
This really does depend on a lot. You know, you'll be in trouble if you...
get it wrong?
I'm just kidding. Oh my God. I'm trying to make you feel like it doesn't even matter.
No, because I want it to be a legend, and you're only a legend if you get 3 out of 3, and I've so far got a half a point. So it's
according
not going
to happen. According to your calculations.
No, you don't.
According to my calculations.
That's how they calculate things in Australia.
I'm just going to go B the whole way, okay?
Wow.
I haven't even heard the last question yet.
Wow. So you're one of those. Like, you're just like, you're going to be stubborn about it now.
The okay, odds. Yeah. I mean, I've got to get one. There's three... Anyway, B.
All right, so B, he challenges him to a cattle roping contest. Surprisingly, no. That didn't happen, although, because it's not a comedy. If it was, I think that would have been really funny, you know, like he would, you know, tie him up and he couldn't join the Nazi army and then be really funny, I guess. No, but actually it was, he slaps him and then drops dead.
Oh.
He actually slaps him, then runs out the door, predicts the coming of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and then dies in his older son's arms.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a very dramatic film.
Gosh. I thought it was a comedy, actually. No,
I know. That's why you chose B.
Yeah.
Got it. So I'm assuming you're going to choose B for this one.
We'll see.
So final question. Swedish actress Ingrid Thalén was cast as the lead female role. And while she was completely fluent in English, the director still decided to have her lines dubbed by what actress? Is it A, Angela Lansbury from Murder, She Wrote? Is it B, Ingrid Bergman, also Swedish, also named Ingrid? Or is it C, Liza Minnelli, the director's daughter? There really is an answer to this.
There really is?
Yeah.
I'm... I feel like my life depends on this right now.
It absolutely does.
Tests stress me out.
Good thing you're in the wine
opening
business.
A New York restaurant doesn't.
Right? Well, I told you I don't do well with multiple choice. So I'm going to go B. I'm going to stick with like the, you know.
Ingrid Bergman, also Swedish, also named Ingrid. No.
God.
I'm glad I'm this convincing, or maybe you're just this defeatist, but
yes,
actually it was Angela Lansbury.
Oh, that I would never have thought that.
But you, I mean,
I didn't think B, but I just went with B.
I mean, she definitely, well, Liza Minnelli would have been like, oh, there are Nazis in the cattle ranch today.
She didn't always talk like that.
No, I only know of like old Liza Minnelli. So, and in 1962, she was probably a teenager. So, I don't know that she'd be. No, I don't know. Okay. Well, anyway, Katrina, thank you so much for being a good sport.
Thanks so much.
I'm really sorry.
I'm gonna go home and watch that film.
Yeah, I mean, it was a box office and critical dud bomb. So maybe don't. Maybe actually, I hear the 1921 version was a lot better.
Okay. I wonder if you'll have customers who reference it.
You know, I've learned something today, and so I'm happy about that.
You've learned what you don't know.
way to see the silver lining.
But I got half a point, right?
Sure. All right. Yeah, you got it. Okay. Yeah, you did get that.
Yeah.
Well, again, thank you so much for being on The Morning After.
Thank you,
it's
Christina.
It's been great. Thank you.
And Sari Kamen.
Thank you, Jesse Kiefer. And thank you to everyone who helped with the show today, including our fantastic engineer, Liz Smith. The break music today was provided by Visa. The theme song to the show is by Jonathan Crowley, and today's sponsor is Route 11 Potato Chips. Very tasty. And thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, tell your friends to subscribe to the show on iTunes. And feel free to get in touch with us at heritageradionetwork.org. Next up, a short clip of Radio Cherry Bomb. See you next week.
I think every woman has some body image moment of some sort, and especially when your passion is food, you work in food, it's bound to affect you in some way or another.
And when you're a restaurant critic, where, I mean, literally your job depends on ingesting as much food as you possibly can.
Every single dish on every single menu, for sure.
On episode 23 of Radio Cherry Bomb, writer and critic Ruth Reichel discusses body image as it relates to food writing.
It's really hard to be a food person and be a woman who, I mean, not only are you yourself affected by your body image, but I think the world, I mean, men have a different way of being in the world. You know, big men are Falstaffian. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get a pass. Mm-hmm. Big women don't. And as someone who was a fat teenager and was miserable about it, I just don't want to be fat again. That's a hard admission.
No,
you know, I wish I didn't care.
Want to learn more about the dichotomous life of the female food critic? Check out episode 23 and all episodes of Radio Cherry Bomb right here on heritageradionetwork.org or iTunes.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.